A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us a prompt about polling, specifically what it actually means when pollsters say they have a representative sample. How do you establish that a sample is representative enough? And does it work the other way around, where you construct samples based on demographic criteria instead of just hoping randomness gets you there? There's a lot of assumed knowledge in those little methodological footnotes, and honestly, most people just skim past them.
They shouldn't, because that's where the entire enterprise lives or dies. The short answer to the prompt's core question is that it works both ways, but the both ways part is where things get interesting. A truly representative sample means every person in the population you're studying has a known, non-zero probability of being selected. That's the gold standard definition from survey methodology. But in practice, almost nobody achieves that anymore.
Because nobody answers their phone.
That's a big part of it. Pew Research Center reported that response rates for their telephone polls dropped to about 4% by 2023. So you're making 100 calls to get 4 completed interviews. And the 4 people who actually pick up and talk to you are systematically different from the 96 who don't.
The 4% who answer unknown numbers are either very lonely or very opinionated.
Or both, which is its own kind of bias problem. But here's the thing. This is where the constructed part of the prompt's question comes in. Modern polling doesn't just collect whatever responses wander in and call it a day. They use something called weighting. You collect your data, you look at the demographics of who actually responded, and then you mathematically adjust so that your sample matches known population benchmarks.
You're saying the representative sample isn't found. It's manufactured after the fact.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. The American Association for Public Opinion Research, AAPOR, has extensive standards around this. The key insight is that you need high-quality benchmark data to weight against. In the U, the gold standard is the American Community Survey from the Census Bureau, which gives you incredibly detailed demographic breakdowns. You know exactly what percentage of the adult population is, say, Hispanic women aged 30 to 49 with a college degree living in the Mountain West. If your survey underrepresents that group, you give the responses more mathematical weight.
Which sounds reasonable until you realize you're assuming that the Hispanic women aged 30 to 49 with college degrees who did answer your survey think the same way as the ones who didn't.
That's exactly the vulnerability. Weighting fixes demographic representation, but it can't fix what pollsters call non-response bias within demographic categories. If the kind of person who answers surveys is more politically engaged, more trusting of institutions, or just has more free time, weighting won't capture that. You're making the assumption of ignorability, that within each demographic cell, the responders and non-responders are essentially similar on the thing you're measuring.
The most honest statistical term ever coined.
It really is. The whole thing rests on a leap of faith dressed up in matrix algebra. But let me back up slightly, because the prompt asked how you establish representativeness, and there's a historical arc here that matters. Before the response rate collapse, the dominant method was random digit dialing, RDD. You generate phone numbers at random and call them. In theory, because nearly every household had a landline, you were sampling from something close to the full population. The design itself gave you a reasonable claim to representativeness.
Then cell phones destroyed that.
Cell phones, caller ID, spam filtering, the death of the landline. By 2024, according to Pew, fewer than 2% of households were landline only. The whole infrastructure that made random digit dialing work just evaporated. So now we're in this hybrid world where major pollsters use something called address-based sampling, ABSA. They pull addresses from the U Postal Service delivery sequence file, which covers something like 97% of residential addresses, and mail invitations to take surveys online.
Wait, they mail you a letter asking you to go to a website. That's the sophisticated replacement for calling people.
It sounds absurdly low-tech, but it solves a real problem. The USPS file is comprehensive in a way phone number lists aren't anymore. Every physical address gets an equal probability of selection. The problem, of course, is that response rates to these mail invitations are also terrible, often in the single digits, so you're back to waiting.
This feels like a philosophical problem masquerading as a technical one. What does representative even mean if every method produces a tiny, self-selected sliver of the population that you then mathematically massage into shape?
This is where you have to distinguish between two kinds of representativeness. There's demographic representativeness. Does your sample match the population on observable characteristics like age, race, gender, education, region? And then there's something deeper, which we might call attitudinal representativeness. Do the opinions in your sample actually reflect the opinions in the population? The first one is testable. The second one is the whole reason you're doing the poll, and you could never directly verify it.
Because if you could verify it, you wouldn't need the poll.
It's the fundamental circularity of survey research. You're estimating the unknown using the known, and the known is always demographics. The leap is assuming that getting the demographics right gets the opinions right. Sometimes that's true. Sometimes it's spectacularly false.
Give me a spectacular failure.
The national polls actually weren't that far off. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by about 2 points, and the final polling averages had her up by about 3. But state-level polls in the upper Midwest systematically underestimated Trump's support, particularly among white voters without college degrees. The postmortem from AA Poor's Evaluation Committee found that many state polls hadn't weighted by education. They'd weighted by age, race, gender, sometimes party identification, but not education. And it turned out that in 2016, education was the single most important demographic cleavage in the electorate.
The weighting was mathematically precise about the wrong things.
And that's the nightmare scenario. You can have beautiful weights, perfect convergence, all your diagnostics looking pristine, and still be wrong because you missed the variable that actually matters for the outcome you're measuring. It's like calibrating a scale perfectly for weight, while what you actually need to measure is height.
The scale is flawless. The patient is still misdiagnosed.
There's another dimension to this that the prompt is getting at with the constructed question. Some panels don't even pretend to start with a probability sample anymore. The Pew American Trends panel, which is one of the most respected survey platforms in the country, is recruited using address-based sampling, so it starts with a real probability foundation. But there are plenty of opt-in panels where people sign up to take surveys for money or points. YouGov, for instance, uses a method called active sampling. They maintain a panel of millions of people who've volunteered, and when they want to run a survey, they select from that panel to match demographic targets.
The sample is representative by design because you're picking specific people from your pool to fill specific demographic buckets.
It's quota sampling with a very large pool and sophisticated matching algorithms. The debate in the field about whether this can truly replicate probability-based sampling is intense and unresolved. YouGov's track record has been decent in recent elections. They were one of the more accurate pollsters in 2020 and 2024, but the methodological question of whether you can construct representativeness from a self-selected pool is still open.
It's the difference between inviting everyone to a party and hoping the right mix shows up, versus sending targeted invitations to specific people who've already told you they like parties.
That's actually a perfect way to put it. And the targeted invitation approach has a genuine advantage, cost. Probability-based panels like Pew's are enormously expensive to maintain. You're mailing tens of thousands of invitations, offering incentives, doing non-response follow-ups. An opt-in panel can run a survey for a fraction of the cost. So there's a real tension between methodological purity and practical constraints.
Which means the public is getting the representation someone's willing to pay for.
Yes, and that's a genuinely under-discussed aspect of this. The margin of error you see reported, typically plus or minus 3 percentage points, that only captures sampling error. It's the error you'd expect from the random variation of drawing a sample of a given size from a population. It assumes your sampling method is perfect and your weighting is flawless. The real error, what pollsters call total survey error, includes coverage error, non-response error, measurement error, and specification error. That true error is almost certainly larger than the reported margin, and nobody knows exactly how much larger.
when a poll says margin of error plus or minus 3%, that's the floor, not the ceiling.
It's the one error source they can calculate cleanly, so it's the one they report. It's not dishonest exactly, but it's deeply misleading to anyone who hasn't taken a survey methodology course. The other thing that complicates all of this is that representativeness isn't a binary property. A sample isn't simply representative or not. It's representative for specific variables to specific tolerance levels. A sample might be perfectly representative for age and gender, somewhat representative for income, and not at all representative for political engagement.
Which brings us back to the prompt's question about how you establish that a sample is representative enough. Enough is doing a lot of work there.
It's doing all the work. And the answer is that you compare your weighted sample to external benchmarks on every variable you can get your hands on. Age distributions from the census. Educational attainment from the American Community Survey. Party registration from state voter files where available. You run down the list and check where your weighted estimates land. If your survey says 22% of adults have a bachelor's degree and the census says 35%, you have a problem.
Again, that's only the observable stuff.
And this is where some pollsters do something clever. They'll include questions whose answers are known from high-quality government surveys, things like smoking rates, or whether someone has a valid driver's license, or internet usage patterns. If your weighted sample matches the benchmarks on these non-political variables, you have some evidence that your weighting is capturing something real. It's not proof that your political questions are right, but it's a reassuring diagnostic.
The pollster equivalent of kicking the tires.
And there's one more layer here that I think gets at the heart of what the prompt is asking. The distinction between establishing representativeness and constructing. It isn't as clean as it sounds. Even in a pure probability sample, you're constructing representativeness through your design choices. Who counts as an adult? Do you include non-citizens? What about incarcerated people? People in nursing homes? People who don't speak English? Every one of those decisions constructs a slightly different population that you're claiming to represent.
The frame creates the picture before you've taken a single shot.
The frame is always a choice. The Census Bureau's definition of the civilian, non-institutionalized population excludes about 8 million people, prisoners, active duty military living in barracks, people in nursing homes. Most political polls follow that definition, which means there's a systematic exclusion that nobody really talks about in the fine print.
What does a well-constructed poll actually do, start to finish, to get to representative?
Let me walk through what Pew does with their American Trends panel, because it's about as rigorous as it gets. Step 1, they draw a random sample of residential addresses from the USPS delivery sequence file. That's the probability foundation. Step 2, they mail invitations to those addresses, offering a small monetary incentive, typically $2 to $5, just for completing the initial profile survey. Step 3, for households that don't respond, they do follow-up mailings, and for a subset, they actually send field interviewers to knock on doors. Step 4, once someone joins the panel, they complete a detailed demographic profile. Step 5, when Pew runs a survey on the panel, they draw a stratified random sample from the panel members, making sure they have enough respondents in smaller demographic groups to analyze separately. Step 6, after data collection, they weight the responses to match census benchmarks on about a dozen variables.
Step 7, pray.
Step 7, yes, hope that the unmeasured characteristics aren't too skewed, but notice what's happening here. The representativeness claim rests on multiple layers. The initial address-based sampling frame, the non-response adjustments, the panel recruitment process, the within-panel sampling design, and the final weighting. At each layer, there are assumptions and potential failure points. The whole thing is a chain, and the chain is only as strong as its weakest link.
Which in 2026 is probably the non-response link.
And it's getting worse, not better. There's been a long-term secular decline in survey participation that predates cell phones, predates the internet. Robert Putnam was writing about declining social trust and civic engagement in bowling alone back in 2000, and survey response rates were already falling then. The internet accelerated it, but the underlying trend is deeper. People are less willing to give their time to strangers asking questions.
There's something almost poignant about that. The entire edifice of public opinion measurement depends on a social norm of cooperation that's been slowly eroding for decades.
We're papering over that erosion with increasingly sophisticated math, which works until it doesn't. The 2020 election was actually a pretty good cycle for polling accuracy. Not perfect, but better than 2016. Then 2022 was quite good. 2024 was mixed, but not disastrous. So the methods are holding up reasonably well in practice, even if the theoretical foundations are shakier than we'd like.
That's almost more unsettling. The methods work until they suddenly don't, and we might not know they've stopped working until after an election surprises everyone.
There's a concept in survey methodology called the bias-variance trade-off that applies here. Pure probability sampling has low bias, but potentially high variance, especially with small samples. Weighted opt-in panels can have lower variance because you're controlling the demographic mix precisely, but they may have higher bias from the self-selection into the panel. Neither approach is uniformly superior. It depends on what you're measuring and how strong the relationship is between the demographic variables you're weighting on and the outcome variable.
The answer to which method is better is the most frustrating answer in all of statistics.
It always depends. But here's something concrete that I think helps answer the prompt's practical question. When you're reading a poll and trying to judge whether the representative sample claim holds water, there are specific things to look for. First, does the pollster disclose their methodology in enough detail that you can actually evaluate it? If they just say, nationally representative sample of registered voters with no further information, that's a red flag. Second, what's the sampling frame? Random digit dial? Opt-in panel? Third, what variables did they weight on? Fourth, what's the response rate or, for opt-in panels, the panel recruitment method?
None of that is in the headline.
None of it. The headline is, Smith leads Jones by 4 points, and you have to dig through a methodology statement to find out whether those 4 points are built on sand or stone. Most people won't do that. Most journalists won't do that.
Is there a regulatory solution here, or is this just the world we live in now?
AAPOR has a transparency initiative that encourages pollsters to disclose their methods, and most of the major ones comply. But it's voluntary. There's no federal polling commission that audits survey methodology. And honestly, I'm not sure there should be. The First Amendment implications of government regulating how opinion polls are conducted are
Herman Poppleberry, reluctant defender of polling's unregulated Wild West.
I contain multitudes. But seriously, the transparency norms have actually improved a lot in the past decade. 538's pollster ratings, before they wound down their politics coverage, created a real incentive for methodological disclosure. Pollsters wanted good ratings, and good ratings required transparency. Market pressure did more than regulation probably could have.
Until the market pressure goes away, when the aggregator goes away.
That's the fragility of it, yes. Which brings me to something the prompt is implicitly asking about that we haven't addressed directly. The question frames this as, how do pollsters establish representativeness? But there's an even more fundamental question, representative of what? Every poll is representative of some defined population. The population might be all you adults, or registered voters, or likely voters, or Republican primary voters in Iowa. Each of those is a different target, requiring different sampling frames and different screening questions.
Likely voters is itself a constructed category.
It's possibly the most constructed category in all of survey research. You're asking people whether they intend to vote, whether they've voted in the past, how closely they're following the election, how enthusiastic they are, and then you're building a model that predicts who will actually show up. The model is based on assumptions about turnout that may or may not hold in the current election. In 2022, a lot of likely voter models underestimated Democratic turnout because they were calibrated on historical patterns that didn't account for the post-Dobbs mobilization.
You're weighting your sample to match demographic benchmarks, and then you're filtering it through a turnout model that's itself an estimate, and then you're reporting the result with a margin of error that only captures one source of uncertainty.
Then cable news puts it in a chyron and calls it a day.
Democracy in action.
Look, I don't want to be too cynical about this. Polling, for all its flaws, is useful. It's better than the alternatives, which are basically pundit intuition and anecdote. The question the prompt is asking, what does representative actually mean, is exactly the right question. The answer is messier than most pollsters want to admit, but that doesn't mean the enterprise is worthless. It means we should be appropriately humble about what polls can tell us.
Appropriately humble is not a phrase that sells ad inventory during election season.
No, it's not. But let me give you an example of where this humility actually shows up in good practice. Pew, again, because they're unusually transparent about this stuff, publishes something called a study-specific analysis for their major surveys. It shows what the unweighted sample looked like, what the weighted sample looks like, and how much the weights shifted things. Sometimes the shifts are modest, a point or two on most variables. Sometimes they're dramatic. When you see a variable where the weighting changed the estimate by 8 or 10 points, that's telling you something important about who's answering your survey.
The weight itself is a measure of non-response.
A large weight on a particular demographic group is an admission that those people didn't respond in sufficient numbers, and you're mathematically amplifying the ones who did. The larger the weights, the more you're leaning on your assumptions. There's a rule of thumb in survey statistics that if your weights have a design effect, a measure of how much the weighting increases your variance, above 2, you should be nervous. Above 3, you should be very nervous.
A poll with a design effect of 3 and a reported margin of error of plus or minus 3 points actually has an effective margin of error closer to 5 or 6.
Almost nobody reports the design effect. They report the unweighted sample size and the unadjusted margin of error, which is calculated as if the sample were a simple random sample, which it almost never is. It's not fraud exactly, it's convention. The convention is misleading, but everyone uses the same convention, so the polls are at least misleading in comparable ways.
Misleading in comparable ways. Put that on a bumper sticker.
I'm full of phrases that will never sell merchandise. But here's the thing. The prompt asked whether representativeness is established or constructed, and the real answer is that it's both, in a loop. You construct a sampling design that, in theory, gives every member of the population a known probability of selection. You collect data and discover that your theory didn't quite work because certain kinds of people didn't respond. You construct weights to correct for that. You compare the weighted results to external benchmarks to establish whether your construction worked. If it didn't, you adjust the construction. The whole thing is an iterative process of construction and verification.
It's less like taking a photograph, and more like painting a portrait from a description.
That's good. And the description is provided by the Census Bureau, which has its own measurement problems. The American Community Survey had its response rates drop during the pandemic, too. The benchmarks themselves have error bars. You're painting a portrait from a description that's itself somewhat blurry.
This is where the sloth brain starts to find the whole enterprise exhausting.
The donkey brain finds it exhilarating, but I acknowledge that's a niche reaction. Let me bring this back to something practical, because I think the prompt is really asking for a usable understanding. When a pollster says, representative sample, what they should mean is, we defined our target population carefully. We used a sampling method that gives every member of that population a known chance of selection. We made extensive efforts to reach the people we selected. We weighted the results to align with the best available demographic benchmarks, and we've disclosed enough detail that you can judge for yourself whether we succeeded. That's the ideal.
How often does that ideal survive contact with reality?
In the best cases, most of it holds. In the worst cases, representative sample means we bought a list and some people answered. The variation in quality is enormous and the branding is identical. That's the real problem. A rigorous probability-based panel and a cheap opt-in panel both claim to be nationally representative, and the consumer has no easy way to tell the difference.
This feels like a labeling problem. We have organic certification for vegetables, but not for public opinion data.
AAPOR actually does have a transparency initiative that's essentially a labeling system. Pollsters who participate disclose their methodology in a standardized format, but it's voluntary, and the disclosure is technical enough that most people won't parse it. It's organic certification where the label is written in Latin.
What would you tell someone who wants to be a responsible consumer of polls? Someone like the prompter, who's clearly trying to understand what's actually being claimed.
First, ignore the margin of error. It's the least informative number in the whole release. Second, look for the weighting variables. If the pollster weighted on age, race, gender, education, and party, that's table stakes. If they also weighted on things like voter registration status, internet usage, or volunteerism, that's a sign of sophistication. Third, check whether they're transparent about their response rate or panel recruitment. If they won't tell you how many people they contacted to get their sample, assume it was very few.
If all of that checks out, trust the poll.
Trust it as a rough estimate with unquantifiable uncertainty. Which is to say, don't trust it. There's a difference. A good poll tells you something real about the direction and approximate magnitude of public opinion. It doesn't tell you that candidate X is ahead by exactly 4 points. The difference between a 4-point lead and a 1-point lead is well within the total survey error of even the best polls.
The precision is performance. The direction is signal.
And the performance of precision is what drives the news cycle. Nobody wants to report that the race appears to be competitive with some evidence of a slight advantage for one candidate. They want to report that Smith surges to 4-point lead in latest poll. The incentives of political journalism and the realities of survey methodology are fundamentally at odds.
Which means the prompter's question, what does representative actually mean, is not just a technical question. It's a question about whether the entire public discourse around polling is built on a misunderstanding.
And the misunderstanding is baked into the language. Representative sample sounds like a property you either have or you don't. In reality, it's a continuum. It's multidimensional, it's constructed, and it's always provisional. Every poll is a model of the population, not a miniature replica of it.
A model, not a miniature. I like that.
It's the difference between a globe and a photograph of the Earth from space. A globe is a model. It's useful for some purposes and misleading for others. A poll is a globe. It shows you the shapes and the relative sizes, but it's not the thing itself, and it was built by people making choices about what to include and how to smooth the edges.
We're all walking around treating globes as if they're satellite imagery.
While the pollsters, the good ones anyway, are quietly muttering about map projections and scale distortions and hoping nobody asks too many questions.
Which brings us back to the prompt's question about construction versus discovery. The pollsters are constructing representativeness, and then they're hoping the construction holds up when reality comes knocking on election day.
Sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't, and the difference between those outcomes is only partly under their control. The rest is just the inherent difficulty of measuring a living, changing population that increasingly doesn't want to be measured. There's something almost noble about it, in a doomed, Sisyphean way.
The nobility of the pollster. Now I've heard everything.
I said almost noble. Don't make me defend it too vigorously.
I won't. But I will say this. The prompter asked a question that seems simple and turns out to be a door into an entire epistemology of public opinion. What does representative mean? It means we've done our best with the tools we have, and our best is better than guessing, but it's not nearly as good as the decimal points would have you believe.
That's a better summary than anything in my methodology textbooks.
The sloth cuts to the chase. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1985, dust storms in Australia's Simpson Desert lofted an estimated 4 million tons of soil into the atmosphere. Satellite imagery later confirmed that roughly 40% of that material crossed the Tasman Sea and deposited across New Zealand's South Island over a 2-week period. The total phosphorus deposited on South Island soils during that single event exceeded what local farmers would typically apply as fertilizer across an entire growing season.
Right, huh?
So the South Island got a free top dressing from Australia. Not sure what to do with that information, but it's in there now. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the facts weird and the audio clean. If you want more episodes, you can find us at My Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.